Welcome back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. And in this season of giving and goodwill, when all is sugar plum fairies and brotherly love, we thought we'd listen back to one of our favorite conversations of the past year about why even the best of us deep down may not be so good after all. Turns out we're all full of powerful, unconscious biases that have an enormous impact on our own lives and on society as a whole. Mahzarin Banaji is a professor of social ethics at Harvard and co-author of the book Blind Spot, Hidden Biases of Good People. She joined us back in February and started by explaining how researchers are uncovering these biases.
For a long time, psychologists have been measuring people's stereotypes and attitudes by asking survey questions. How do you feel? How do you think? But now we can bypass some of those simple questions. What we can do is get underneath the surface a little bit.
We actually, I don't really want to call it a test. It was more of a challenge that we presented along these lines to our fellow journalists. They were our guinea pigs right here at WBUR. A very good bunch of people, I have to say. So this challenge was a simple question, and it's actually one that's right in your book.
I'll read the riddle, and let's see what your listeners think. A father and his son are in a car accident. The father dies at the scene, and the son, badly injured, is rushed to the hospital. In the operating room, the surgeon looks at the boy and says, "I can't operate on this boy. He's my son." How can this be?
So that's the questions. Listeners, think about how you might answer. And while you do, here's what our WBUR colleagues said.
Perhaps he meant grandson and he just left out the grand really quickly. No, that's not right.
The father who died at the accident was the stepfather.
Because the father in the car that died with the boy is actually a priest.
It's a same-sex marriage.
Or the dad didn't really die and was revived somehow and rushed to the hospital and...
One of the fathers was a sperm donor?
Perhaps he could be the biological father?
I don't know.
Okay, so I'm almost taken aback by the extreme mental gymnastics that we just heard for what's supposed to be an easy question. And what's remarkable is these are journalists, remember. They're trained to be observant and to really think about hidden meaning.
Surgeon. Can't operate. Car accident. I'm dissecting the words because there's some clue in there, right? Can I read your mind, do you think?
Aren't we all everybody's sons in the end?
Or maybe the boy died and he was dreaming, or that was like his transition to the afterlife and he met his father again. Obviously, that is not right. What's the answer?
So, Mahzarin, what is the answer?
The surgeon is his mother.
Of course. I mean, once you say it, it's the most obvious thing in the world, and I'm sure that a lot of people listening got the answer straight away. We have to say one person here did at WBUR, so props to her. But I will also admit that this morning when that riddle was given to me, I got it wrong. And I went through all sorts of the similar mental gymnastics to find a right answer when the obvious one completely escaped me. And it's embarrassing, but why does that happen?
It happens for a very simple reason, and that is that we learn. We learn things in our environment. So when you hear the word surgeon, you think you're just imagining somebody who's going to perform surgery, somebody who wears a white lab coat, somebody associated with blood and knives and who's going to help somebody live. Those are the thoughts that come to our mind when we ask people, what does surgeon remind you of? Very few people might say, surgeon, male. But that's indeed one of the associations to the word surgeon.
So that's the natural assumption that's going on in our head.
It is. It is. Gender is a very potent component of these professions because we see people in these roles. And likewise, if we had said it was a nurse, there would have been an automatic immediate trigger that the person we're speaking about is female.
Now, in the book, you also note that the question is worded in a very specific way, and that is like most of the pronouns in the question are male-gendered pronouns, and that has an effect on what we presume the answer to be.
Right. So first of all, we should know, when I read this little riddle to you, nothing about it should have sounded odd. It could have been something that appears in front of us, and yet... Yes, we should recognize that the words father, his, son, boy, he, all of these pronouns and other words that in some way signal male are embedded in it, all of which are going in the same direction of triggering
father.
Does this mean that if the pronouns, some of them were female gendered, that people might have more easily said the surgeon was the mother?
Absolutely. I think that we could change this around and we might be more easily able to produce this. For example, instead of saying that a boy had died, if we just said that a girl had died, that may have been enough to make people think, as soon as you see a girl, other possible girls come to mind.
It's so fascinating. So even the most minor triggers have an enormous effect in terms of what we think we're seeing in the world.
And that has been one of the lessons from experimental psychology, that very little things can trigger thoughts and feelings that, when they all add up, could produce a fairly big effect, like the one we just observed.
Okay, so this has some amusing but also very serious consequences, obviously, in how we live. And what was even more fascinating, you know, given that we did this, you know, our little riddle on my fellow good-natured, good-sported colleagues here at WBUR, is that, you know, I can attest they are all very open-minded people. These are not people who come to the table with biases, you know, that they're proud of it in any way, shape, or form. And so when we actually revealed the right answer to them, that the surgeon was a mother, their response was almost as interesting as the fact that they got the question wrong to begin with. So let's listen to what they said.
Oh, no.
Oh, wait a minute. But when you...
And I didn't get that? That is so embarrassing. Oh, my God.
Whoa.
Oh, for all the gender rights I fight for, I feel so small right now.
Fascinating. I mean, so what does this tell us, that we're so surprised by how heavily influenced we are to all these triggers on, you know, how and what we think?
It is precisely for this reason that we became interested in indirect tests of bias rather than the usual direct tests that we pose to people when we say to them, how do you feel about people from this group? Would you let your daughter date somebody from that group? Those are questions we're interested in far less than these slightly more indirect ways of asking the question. It's partly because we observe them in ourselves. Mm-hmm. I was given this riddle in 1985, and I just couldn't get the right answer. And I was, like many of your colleagues here, mortified by it. And here I am, a professor whose job it is to be training and be trained in the methods of analytic thought, to be able to slice through any argument and to get to the heart of it and find the right answer. And here was this seemingly dumb question, and I failed it.
Right. And that just leads us to thinking, I mean, one of my colleagues asked, I wonder what this means for all the biases that I don't realize are influencing my daily thought and action.
Your colleague is a very wise person, because that's exactly the question we all ought to be asking ourselves. If this is the case, what are all the other biases? And this is where the implicit association test may come in handy, because we can't develop the perfect riddles to test everything, but the test might be a way to gain some understanding about what it is that lies in our minds.
Well, we'll talk about that test in more detail in just a moment. Listeners, my guest is Mahzarin Banaji. She's co-author, along with Anthony Greenwald, of the new book Blind Spot: Hidden Biases of Good People. You open your book by talking about a thing called mind bugs. What are mind bugs?
Mind bugs are simply ingrained habits of thought. And having become habits of thought, they can lead us to errors in how we perceive people, how we remember things about them, how we reason about them, and how we make decisions about them.
Give us some examples.
What we just observed in the riddle is a mind bug. We can think about our brains as machines that run a certain kind of software, and the software is just buggy. The word mind bugs was used to refer to the systematic errors that young children made when they first learn to subtract. When they have to learn to carry, they all make a particular set of mistakes before they say, aha, now I get it. And we want to use the term mind bugs in this context in part to demystify these biases, to talk about them as fairly ordinary things, beliefs that elderly people are in some way forgetful, that Koreans are shy, that Asians might be good at math, that Boston drivers are aggressive, that
you
women
mean that's not
are
nurturing.
Yeah. So they all are true in the sense that if you took just the means of these groups, you might find, indeed, that on average, Asians score higher on math tests than do other groups of people. That's possible. The problem is that the differences may not be large, but when we encounter people from these groups, we might use the stereotype to assume that we can tell a lot about the person. Hmm. And those are the kinds of errors that we make.
Now, the mind bugs come in different varieties. I mean, you talk about something called, for example, anchoring, that our brains use information, reference information that's available or that has come before in order to infer things or information that we're not given. Do we know how... how frequent that is, or how powerful that anchoring effect is?
Our minds are filled with ways in which we might respond that lead us to be less than perfectly rational. Okay, so there is one view of human nature, and that is that human beings are largely rational. There is a slightly different view that we don't always make the right decisions, not even the decisions that are in our own interests. And these come from the kind of example that you use, like anchoring, where if I throw a big number out at you and then I ask you, hey, how much would you pay for this book? If I throw a big number out at you, you're likely to tell me you'll pay $30 for this book. But if I threw a little number out at you, like two, and then said, how much would you pay for this book? You might say 10 bucks. Now, the fact that our minds are taken by the placement of a large or a small word before I ask you what this book is worth tells us how deeply ingrained they are. So I would argue they are very pervasive and they're very potent.
Well, let me ask you, though. Human beings are enormously social creatures, and we also can't have perfect information about our world. So isn't this ability to craft some sort of inference and fill in the blanks, to fill in our blind spots, actually, in a way, essential for the functioning of human society?
It is absolutely essential. No creature that has what we would call intelligence can be devoid of these biases. And they're there for a reason. They served our ancestors quite well. So when our ancestors lived in small communities of people who were just like themselves, and they encountered others who were a little bit different from them, it was reasonable in the old world to ask the question, are they going to kill me or should I kill them? Now, modern humans live in societies with people who are massively different from them. They're genetically different, they're socioculturally different, and the questions that we have to answer about other people are a little different. Should I outsource to this person? Should I collaborate with them? Should I work with them to beat somebody who's from my own group, but who in this case is a competitor? So our brains now have to make a very different set of choices and decisions, and what we urge readers to do is to simply pay attention to the fact that some of the ways in which we think may be leftovers from a long time ago.
Well, and what's interesting is how infrequently people even realize that this is going on, because you write in the book about a very simple test that you give people where in front of a volunteer you put a photograph of a person, nothing else really, just a photograph of a person, and you ask, does this person like skiing? Mm. And there isn't any information in the picture really that might help us understand, do they like skiing or not? And people have an answer. Nobody says, I don't know.
Exactly. So human beings are natural analyzers of other minds. We are fascinated by what's in the mind of other people. Even when we seemingly are doing nothing, our brain is thinking about others, their motives, their goals, our own, our alliances with them, and so on. And so when you show people a still photograph of somebody and you say, how trustworthy is this person? Everybody we ask that question to gives us an answer. Hmm. Nobody has said, I can't tell you, which is the right answer, really.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the social and societal implications of this research are enormous, actually, because, for example, you write in the book how in cases of wrongful conviction, and these are people who have spent significant amount of time in jail and related later perhaps exonerated through DNA, that 75%, there have been findings that 75% of these wrongful convictions happened because of eyewitness accounts, so-called eyewitness accounts, and yet it was these hidden biases that may have led people to think they were seeing someone or something that didn't actually commit the crime.
That's exactly right. This is one of the most important results from the last half century, that many of us genuinely believe that we have seen and remembered something only to discover, because the hard evidence these days, of course, DNA evidence, shows us that we could not have been right. And that sort of evidence is one of the kinds of mind bugs that we think go into creating these beliefs that this type of person from this group is capable or is worthy of being an engineer or a lawyer or a doctor. And what we're interested in is simply alerting people, making them aware the fact that these may exist in their minds.
Listeners, I'm speaking with Mahzarin Banaji. She's a professor of social ethics at Harvard and co-author with Anthony Greenwald of the new book Blind Spot, Hidden Biases of Good People. I took the implicit association test regarding race. I was very
Bold
nervous,
woman.
Very nervous to take it because it gives you a result of whether you have automatic preferences for African Americans or European Americans. And most Americans who have taken this test, turns out, have an automatic preference for European Americans. First of all, what does that mean?
Yeah. So let's just talk about the test. The test at the website obliges you to try to rapidly associate good and bad things with the groups European American and African American. I have taken this test many times. I am not proud of my result. I'm deeply humbled by it because I have an easier time associating white with good than black with good. This is not something I like at all about myself, that this association is strong enough in my mind that I can't just, you know, change it on the test. We should break the data down by who's taking the test. Mm-hmm. So if we look at white Americans, roughly 70% of white Americans show a faster association of white with good than black with good. If you look at African Americans, they show a quite different pattern. If the world were sort of roughly an even place, and let's say each group shows liking for its own, then we should expect that something like 70% of African Americans would show an association of black with good.
But that doesn't happen.
But that doesn't happen. About 40% of African Americans show in-group preference. Another 40% actually show white preference.
Okay, we've just got a couple minutes to go, so I'm sorry to rush you along, but this leads to a massive question here. This doesn't necessarily mean that people who are taking this test and show their preference are prejudiced, though. I mean, is it more a reflection of societal values versus individual prejudice?
So first of all, yes, it is absolutely the case that these tests do not measure what we typically mean by prejudice. I think we should use the word prejudice to refer to one's conscious feelings of antipathy towards members of another group. This test does not tap into that at all. It's measuring some kind of a thumbprint of the culture on our brain. However, it now is our brain.
Okay,
so we're doing the work and showing the biases ourselves.
So given that, what is the beginnings of your answer to this question of if we are so influenced by that thumbprint of society on our brains, you know, how do we move to a more just society when all of these hidden influences are constantly, I don't want to say dictating, but influencing our individual actions?
Yeah. Awareness, awareness, awareness. I think that's hugely important. In the hands of smart thinking people who care to do the right thing, we can make lots of changes that will make sure that the biases we observe on the test does not translate into our behavior.
Awareness, awareness, awareness. I mean, is there a way to sort of actively have mental exercises every day in order to produce that awareness?
Yes, there are. And one simple tool is to think about the counter or the opposite of the stereotype, right? So if you know that there is a particular stereotype in our culture that has become ingrained in us, then one thing we can practice using images, the media here is incredibly important. Look at just how much we've changed. Think about just 10 years ago when our attitudes towards gay people in this country were quite different than what they are today. You know, and people were uncomfortable having a gay coworker at work 10 years ago. And that has changed dramatically. And I asked the question, why? And I think it's the media. It's people like you, Meghna, and people in Hollywood who have brought awareness to this issue, who have made sure that our associations to gay have changed to be nice, cool, fun, good person.
So change is possible, but it takes time across a society. Well, Mahzarin Banaji is co-author of Blind Spot, The Hidden Biases of Good People. It is a phenomenal read. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you, Meghna.
And listeners, let us know what you think your hidden biases are. Continue this conversation at radioboston.org. There's more of the show coming up. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.